him by the shirt front and say, "Outside. Now." His brows lift. Behind me, Logan says, "Kate, he's having a conversation with me. This won't take long. Now move, asshole." Those brows rise higher, but I march him to the exit by the stairs. The entrance door is only secured with an internal deadbolt. I undo it and push him outside. When we're far enough from the building, I swing in front of him.
"You must be the sister,"
he says, looking amused. "And you must be the jerk roommate who's been hassling my brother, who stomped off when he saved your ass from your blood-sucking afterlife."
"Kate,"
Logan says behind me, his footfalls swishing over the dew-damp grass.
"It's fine, Kate."
"Has he thanked you yet?" I ask.
"There's no need."
"The hell there isn't." I turn on Mason. "You can't treat people like shit and expect them to stick their neck out for you. You're lucky Logan didn't just run to camp, yelling for help, telling them you were dead. By then you would have been. And let's hope your family knows enough not to embalm you, or you're going to have the worst vamp life ever. Logan brought you back to life, and you walked away without letting him know you were okay, let alone thanking him."
"I didn't ask him to save me."
I sputter. "What the hell? I bet you told your parents you didn't ask to be born either. Seriously? You need an image makeover. Emo vamp is so 1990. Wear bright colors. Smile once in a while. Say thank you." Mason starts to walk away.
"As amusing as this is, I don't have time."
I haul him back. "Oh, you'll make time. Logan might not get into a pissing match with you, but I will. You want to compare fangs?" I lean into his face. "Trust me, mine are bigger." From behind me comes soft laughter that must be Holly.
"Just apologize," she says. "Kate's not letting you go until you do."
"I'm sure I've already thanked him."
I turn to Logan, who shrugs.
"That's a no," I say.
"Fine," Mason calls a too bright. "Thanks, roomie."
He turns back to me.
"Better? I'm not sure he actually saved me, though, considering this."
Mason yanks up his shirt. It's awash with smeared blood.
"You two got in a fight again?" I say.
"Well, I'm sure you started it. And I don't see any damage, so quit whining."
"Whining?"
"He was slashed with a knife," Logan says. Logan doesn't need to clarify that it wasn't him. We don't use weapons.
"Where?"
I ask.
"Here."
Mason points to unmarked skin under the smear of blood.
"Asshole split me open a good 6 inches. Bled like a son of a bitch. That was 10 minutes ago."
"You healed," I say. "Like a vamp. You're obviously alive, though." I peer at the spot and then straighten. "Logan mentioned you were part of an Edison Group experiment. I know they played with side effects. They might have given you pre-vamp life healing abilities. But I'm sure you'd have noticed by now."
"Kinda."
"Huh." I glance at Logan. "So the death and resurrection cycle triggered a partial change to vamphood."
"That's what I presume," Logan says.
I turn back to Mason. "If you start craving blood, do not ask my brother to donate. He's done enough for you already. Start with the guy who stabbed you. Unless you deserved it."
"He didn't," Logan says. "It was that kid you talked to in the dinner line. The blonde. Hayden."
"You mean the aberzombie who talked at me?" "Let me guess. You mouthed off to him. I've heard you like to do that."
"I didn't. He came for your brother. To cut his Achilles tendon while he slept."
I may be somewhat incoherent for the next few minutes. Logan explains once I'm calm enough to listen.
but every sentence only reignites my rage. It doesn't help that my brother stays completely cool, as if these guys really had snuck in for a camp prank, as he first presumed. I'll be angry for him. This has always been my role in our relationship. I rant and stomp and throw things, channeling his rage in a way he cannot. They tried to lame my brother. If this asshole's dad is really a doctor, he'd have known exactly what he was doing. It's called the Achilles tendon after the Greek Achilles, whose mother had protected him by dipping him into the river Styx while holding that part of his body, meaning it was his only vulnerable spot. Like most myths, it has a deeper meaning. We are all vulnerable there. It's a necessary tendon for walking, running, and jumping. Cut that, and my brother would have been sent home with a serious injury, perhaps never able to run or jump properly again. For a werewolf? That would be catastrophic. This was no prank. It was malicious and cruel. And the only thing my brother did to deserve it was to be born a werewolf. There really is something going on, Holly says. Those guys are jerks, but this is insane. Logan explains the hormone overdrive theory to Mason. When the vampire rolls his eyes, Holly says, "You were a real jerk the other night. Are you telling me that's normal for you?"
"Yep. Sorry. No excuse for my behavior except that I don't want to be here. And if I have to be here, I want to be left alone."
"I introduced myself," she says. "I wasn't hitting on you, wasn't asking for your life story, wasn't trying to make a new BFF. I said, 'Hello, I'm Holly.'" He shrugs, but color touches his cheeks in a look that says it's a whole lot easier to be nasty to a stranger.
"I'm an asshole," he says.
"And proud of it," she mutters.
"Should we warn Elijah?" I say. "Regardless of what's causing this, these guys have a batshit crazy issue with werewolves. Emphasis on the crazy."
"Elijah?" Mason says. "Wait, that's the dude with the dreads, isn't it? He's a werewolf too? Fuck. Maybe Surfer Boy had a point. You guys are taking over."
"We are," I say. "So please feel free to jump onto Team Surfer."
"Let's leave Elijah out of it for now," Logan says. "No one else knows he's a werewolf, not even the counselors. We can quietly warn him in the morning. I don't want to call attention to this."
"You were attacked with a knife," I say. "In your bed. At the very least, we need to tell the counselors."
"Do you trust them to handle this?" Logan says. "Or will they make it worse?"
He's right. I remember Trisha when we got back from the cabin walk. Earlier today, she didn't want to tell the others what we are. Now she's openly talking about it herself. The cheerleading counselor has vanished, replaced by a petulant and testy babysitter. Something hormonal is sparking aggression and libido, increasing both tension and mood swings. Yet we are teens. Sometimes I want to just slam my fist into the wall for no reason. Sometimes I want to invite random cute guys into the nearest dark hallway and make out with them. Other times I want to go in my room, shut the door, and cry. And all three impulses can take place in a single day, or a single hour. Yet, the situation here is exaggerated. It's as if someone went looking for a teen movie scriptwriter and hired a 60-year-old who hasn't spoken to an actual teen in 30 years. Worse, whatever's going on, the counselors aren't immune to it. "Paige will be here tomorrow," Logan says. "We keep saying that."
"I know, but it's true. Do you think we're in serious danger? If you do, then let's pack our bags and head into the forest. We can hike to the nearest town."
I shake my head. No, you're right. As angry as I am about what happened to you, it's three guys, not a lynch mob. We're on alert now. We'll stick together until Paige gets here. What about calling her? I say. The cell phones are in the office, and I know where that is. Wake her in the middle of the night to say weird stuff is happening? That some guys came after me, but I'm fine? It's... He checks his watch. 3 in the morning here, which makes it midnight in Portland. Too late for her to catch a flight. She's due here around noon tomorrow, so she must already be booked on the first flight out. If you are really concerned, we can call Mom and Dad. If I was really concerned, I'd do what you said. Grab my bag and head out. I'm not there yet. So you're right. Hanging tight and waiting for Paige is the best option. I just really don't like it.
Neither do I.
Chapter 23. Kate. The next morning, Holly and I head into the dining hall for breakfast. We've decided to play this cool, not hang out in our little pack, as Trisha called it. That would signal fear, closing our ranks. Whatever is happening here, not everyone is affected. I'm not sure I'd know if I was. I'm already prone to mood swings and making out with guys I've just met. Logan's testosterone is definitely spiking, but only around Elijah, which is normal for werewolves. Maybe, as adolescent werewolves, we're already too high on hormones to notice an increase. I don't see anything with Holly and Alan, though. Whatever's happening, it only impacts some campers. Why? Well, that's the question, isn't it?
You can have breakfast with Elijah if you want, Holly says as we walk to the dining hall. You two don't need a third wheel.
You're not a third wheel, I say. You're a second wheel. Unless that's a polite brush off.
Definitely not.
Then it's you and me for breakfast. I want to hear about your Sabrina training. As we walk through the dining hall, I spot Elijah. Damn it. I just told Holly I was going to have breakfast with her. Just her. But I do need to speak to Elijah about last night. I'm still figuring this out when he looks over. He goes still, as if trying to decide whether to join us or hang out with others. I glance his way, ready to motion that I need to speak to him a moment. Yet, as I turn, he wheels, and I'm left looking at his back. Then he makes an exaggerated show of checking his watch and stiffening in a shit, I forgot something way before he lopes off down the other hall.
Did Elijah just dodge me?
Did he duck out before I could pounce and insist on eating with him? Annoyance darts through me. I've done nothing to suggest I'm that kind of girl. Sure, I hauled him to talk to Logan when I first discovered he was a werewolf, but after that he was free to leave. Logan made it clear he'd like Elijah to leave. It was Elijah who tagged along. It was also Elijah who invited me on the kitchen raid. I'd been the one watching the time, not wanting to make Holly stay up late waiting for me. He'd been the one delaying my departure until the last possible moment. I'm overanalyzing this, aren't I? Elijah wants to have breakfast with someone else, and rather than say so, he pretended not to see me. That isn't cool, but he doesn't know me well enough to realize he could just say, catch you later. He overreacted. And now I'm overreacting. I do need to speak to him about what happened with Logan. But my brother's right. No one realizes Elijah's a werewolf, so he's in no immediate danger. I'll warn him later. I forget Elijah and gather my breakfast. No one comments on my overflowing plate this time. I hear the whispers, though, snaking down the line. She's a werewolf, the Alpha's daughter. Her brother's here, too. Oh, did you hear about the vampire? Vampire? I also catch other whispers. I'd do her. Oh, yeah, I hear werewolves like it rough. She's cute, but have you seen her brother? Damn. Whatever is happening here, the heightened sex drive is at least as strong as the heightened aggression. And so far, those two haven't overlapped, thankfully. I've barely even formed that thought before a guy says,
"Hey, I thought you were coming to my room last night."
He's talking to a girl ahead in line who's giggling with another girl. When she doesn't respond, he surges forward.
"Hey," he says, "I'm talking to you."
He grabs for her arm, and I'm setting my plate down, ready to run interference. But the girl tosses his hand off easily.
"I changed my mind," she says. "Especially since you apparently found company elsewhere."
"I don't know what you're talking about,"
he says, in that fake belligerent tone that says he knows exactly what she means and he's wondering how he got caught.
"You found someone else," she says. "And so did I."
"What? Who?"
The girl puts a hand behind her friend's neck and kisses her. The guys nearby break out in hoots and cheers. And even her would-be suitor eases back with,
"Hell, if you told me that, I'd have said bring her along."
There's a round of laughter. Holly shakes her head, and we break from line to find a table.
"Why do I feel like I've stumbled into a bad teen sex comedy?" I mutter.
"Better than a bad teen horror movie," Holly says.
"True enough. I just hope the camp supplies condoms."
They covered that in the orientation. They're with the bandages, insect repellents, and other first aid supplies.
Excellent.
From the sounds of it, whatever's going on with the girls is heating up, and the ring around them grows as others walk over to watch and yell encouragement.
"Not my idea of breakfast entertainment," I say.
"Dinner theater, maybe, but it's too early for that shit."
Holly laughs.
"Agreed. Want to see if we can sneak outside to eat?"
I do. On the way out, I spot Logan, but he's with Alan on the other side of the buffet fracas. I catch his eye just long enough to wave. Then I follow Holly out. No one comes after us, and we eat at a picnic table outside. I want to get to know Holly better, so I ask questions. I don't get much. She said earlier that she has the most boring, happy family imaginable, and she sticks to that. Her family is great, very close and loving. She's just an average girl with an average life. Nothing else to say, really. That could be true, but I feel as if she's dodging and deflecting. And that stings a little. I'm not asking for her life story. I'm not trying to intrude. I'm just reaching out, showing interest, because I am interested. But a door has been slammed in the nicest, politest way. So we talk about the Sabrinas. If I'm hoping for insight into Holly and her life that way, I don't get it. Maybe there's nothing to tell. Or maybe I haven't earned it yet. I accept that. After breakfast, other campers wander outside. Apparently, scheduled activities for the morning have been canceled while the counselors call an emergency staff meeting to discuss behavior issues. To me, that sounds a whole lot more like the prison guards retreating to a locked room and letting the inmates run wild until the warden shows up. They're waiting for Paige. Despite the counselors retreating, it's a quiet morning. Alan comes out around 10 and says Logan's in his room talking to Mason. And most of the campers are holed up organizing a party, judging by what he overheard. It's nearly 11 when I go inside to hunt down a mid-morning snack. Holly says they put out bowls of granola bars and fruit for us to graze on, and I am in serious need of grazing. I'm looking for the bowls when I catch a familiar scent. I turn to see Elijah poised just inside the doorway.
"Hey,"
I say, heading over to him. "I'm snack hunting right now, but you and I need to chat." He backs up fast, his hands rising to ward me off. I stop short.
"What the hell's that for?"
Do I look like I'm running over to throw myself on you?
No, no.
My annoyance from earlier surges. I didn't fail to notice you running from me this morning, Elijah. I was turning to say hello, that's it. Say hello and let you know I plan to eat breakfast with Holly. I'm not a leech. I don't cling to real boyfriends, let alone fake ones.
Yeah, about that.
He inhales, not meeting my eyes.
I don't think the girlfriend stuff is a good idea.
My heart stutters, and I have to remind myself, I wasn't really dating Elijah. Don't take this personally. It was a relationship of convenience, and if it's no longer convenient for one party, that's fine. Even if it doesn't feel fine.
You're great, Kate,
he begins.
But,
whoa, I lift my hands. You're my fake boyfriend. You don't need to dump me for real. You've changed your mind. That's cool. Done. We are no longer a pretend couple. Now, I really do need to talk to you. Help me find a snack and...
No,
he cuts in.
It's not just the dating thing. I don't think any of this is a good idea. I'm sorry.
He turns and strides into the hall. I stand there, stunned. Then I jog after him, staying well back so it's clear I'm not chasing him. Elijah, I call. I need to talk to you. It has nothing to do with us. He shakes his head and breaks into a lope. Elijah, I call. Take a hint, a voice says behind me, and I turn to see a counselor. Behind her, the others stream into the dining hall as if their meeting is done. You got dumped, she says. Deal with it. Don't humiliate yourself by chasing him. No, I blink hard, forcing myself to change mental gears. When is Paige coming? That's Mrs. Winterbourne to you. Paige is a family friend. I force a smile, trying to sound casual. Well, aren't you special? I swallow a retort and ask calmly, when is Mrs. Winterbourne arriving? She's not. The counselor starts walking off. Her kid woke up puking sick, and apparently he needs his mommy. She's coming tomorrow. Wait, I jog after her. I really need to speak to her. Can I use my cell? I'll skip my evening call. Will you? She turns to me. You might be special where you come from, Miss Werewolf Princess, but to me, you're nothing but a spoiled little bitch dog, one who needs to be taught a lesson. I stare at her, just stare, as she wheels and swans off to join the others. Okay, something is definitely wrong here, and it's getting worse. The whole situation is getting worse, and Paige isn't coming. I need to find Logan.
Chapter 24. Logan. After I was attacked, the rest of the night passed without incident. I rigged up a makeshift alarm for the door to alert us to entry. Mason looked at it, snorted, and shoved the dresser in front of the door instead. Even with that, I don't think either of us slept. I rest until a bell signals breakfast, and then I ask Mason whether he's eating, but he only rolls over and grunts. As soon as I leave, though, I hear the dresser being shoved back in front of the door. Alan's also heading for breakfast, so we fall in step together. I tell him a bit about what happened last night. We're still talking as we join the line for the breakfast buffet, and it takes a couple of minutes to realize something's happening up ahead. A commotion that has guys gathering like they do when a fight breaks out. I stiffen, ready to leave. Until Paige arrives, I'll force myself to retreat from any situation that looks as if it could erupt in violence. I hear catcalls and whoops, which don't sound like audience reactions to a fight. I ask Alan, who only shrugs and says, "I don't even want to know what it is. I'm starting to feel like I'm living in a zoo, except those who are actually part animal aren't the ones acting like it." He pauses. "That didn't come out right. I don't mean you're less human." Another pause. "How do you guys think of it?" In the pack, we do consider ourselves part wolf and part human. Just as you might say you inherited certain characteristics from your mother and certain ones from your father. That doesn't make you two people. It's a seamless blending. I realize I've switched into lecture mode and scoop up a forkful of bacon as I say, "The short version is that we'd be insulted if you said we were subhuman, but not if you call us part human. To us, the wolf doesn't negate the human." "Makes sense. Oh, there's Kate and Holly. Looks like they've got their food, and they're ducking whatever's going on." I catch my sister's eye, and I'm going to ask what's happening, but she only smiles and waves and then continues for the door. She's obviously heading outdoors to enjoy breakfast with Holly, so I won't interfere. My sister never had a wide circle of friends, but in middle school, she had no end of girls wanting to befriend her, and she'd had a decent group of pals. In high school, that slowly constricted. I know my sister misses that female friendship, and I'm glad to see her hanging out with Holly. After breakfast, the staff disappears into a meeting, and a bunch of the campers do, too, planning some kind of party. While the counselors are away, the campers will play. The buffet is still out. I decide to take food for Mason, and Alan decides that's the point at which we part company. "I'm sure he's secretly a great guy," Alan says. "No, he's not, but he should still eat." Alan smiles and shakes his head. "You'll make a great dad someday. However, not being nearly so charitable, I'll skip the company of the brooding vamp and go find Holly and Kate." I take the food to Mason and then immediately wish I hadn't. I could have foreseen that, couldn't I? While I'd love to believe he'll accept the gesture for what it is, simple consideration, if asked to predict his response, I'd have said he'd see the food as a bribe or a solicitation for friendship. Or a solicitation for more than friendship, the werewolf equivalent of bringing him flowers. Admittedly, had I predicted the last one, I wouldn't have brought it. Last night, our attackers said Mason is gay. That doesn't jibe with his seemingly homophobic comments from earlier. And I suppose that could mean those guys were wrong. However, Mason didn't argue the point either. Does that mean his comments weren't homophobic, but rather like a female roommate warning me about sneaking into her bed in the middle of the night? I don't care what Mason is. I could just do with a little less of him acting as if every friendly word and gesture is a come-on. It's exhausting. I wasn't lying last night. My sexual orientation remains a mystery even to me. Maybe that suggests I'm bisexual. Maybe it just puts me somewhere on the spectrum, and I won't know which way I lean until I have an actual romantic encounter, and I'm in no rush to do that. For me, it isn't a question urgently requiring an answer, and I don't appreciate being grilled on it by a near stranger. So Mason hints that I'm bringing him flowers, and I ignore him. That seems the best defense. I leave the food, and I grab a book and plunk onto my bed, only because I don't want to walk out and seem like he was right and I'm fleeing in embarrassment. I read for the next hour. He eats the food and then plugs in his earbuds. After an hour, I head out, planning to join Kate and the others. I decide to grab snacks from the dining hall first, and I'm heading for the stairs when I see Elijah. He glances over his shoulder, as if for an escape route. Escaping me? Afraid of me? I'm fine with that. it just surprises me. At school, I'm the quiet, studious kid who never makes waves, never causes trouble, certainly doesn't scare anyone. Even if I have the physique to fight, no one has any reason to start one with me. In the last 24 hours, I've fought Mason and those guys last night, and I won easily. I threatened Elijah, and now he's obviously trying to avoid an encounter. Here I am someone new. Here I am a guy you don't cross. Here I am Clayton Danvers' son. Even as I recoil from the thought, a frisson of satisfaction runs through me. Hell yeah, I'm Clay Danvers' kid. What? No, that's Kate, and she can keep it. I'm the thoughtful one, the careful one, the brains, not the brawn. Except Kate has her own brains, and I have my own brawn. Dad has a freaking PhD. He is the brains and the brawn. Yet Dad is not the calm and reasonable one. He's the homing missile, the smart weapon. But a weapon nonetheless, and I'm standing here, trapped in the web of my anxieties, while Elijah is about to breathe a sigh of relief and retreat. I walk toward him, on an angle that means his only escape route is straight through a gaggle of the popular girls, the same girls he's apparently avoiding. Is he really avoiding them, or did he use that as an excuse to get close to my sister? I saw how he looked at her yesterday. Kate isn't some random girl he asked to help him out. He's interested, and she's oblivious to that. Just happy to hang out with a cute guy who also happens to be a werewolf. Seeing himself cornered, Elijah plasters on a fake smile.
Hey, you? Good morning.
We need to talk.
Sure. Later, though. Right now?
Don't worry, it isn't about Kate. We need to talk about what's going on, your theory. Wait here while I grab some fruit. As I walk away, one of the girls giggles and says to Elijah,
Hey, you. Forgot his name, didn't you?
Nah, I know it, Elijah says. Can't forget it. It was also my brother's, which is awkward.
I slow as I listen.
It was your brother's, the girl says. Your brother's dead? I'm so sorry. That guy is such a jerk. For daring to have the same name, another girl says. Don't be stupid. Elijah, I'm so sorry to hear that, though. What happened to your brother?
Elijah seems to be struggling for a polite way to say, none of your business. Instead, he says,
He fell in with a bad crowd, and it got him killed.
A gang?
One girl says breathlessly. Another girl's voice rises as she says,
Oh my God, did you actually say that?
Elijah laughs softly.
It actually kind of was a gang. Now, if you will excuse me, ladies, I'm going to duck out before he comes back.
They cluck sympathetically as he flees. I don't pursue. I'm standing at the table, still littered with the remains of breakfast, looking more like an abandoned pig's trough than a buffet. My mind whirs as I stand with my hand poised over an apple.
I know it. Can't forget it. It was also my brother's. Fell in with a bad crowd, and it got him killed. It actually kinda was a gang.
I turn to see Elijah taking off at a lope. He glances sideways down the hall, and his profile. The girls notice me watching and fan out, as if to block him from my view. I still see him, though, in my mind. That profile. That face. I knew I'd seen it before. Now the answer hits with a rush that sets my heart pounding, my brain shouting that I'm being silly. Worse than silly. I'm being racist. Seeing a black werewolf and jumping to an imagined resemblance to one of the few I know. I reach for my phone. It's not there, of course. but I can pull up what I want from memory. When we got our first cell phones, Kate and I had taken pictures of the pack. Kate played amateur photographer, sneaking around like a paparazzi, wanting real people, not their smiling, photo-ready faces. I wanted the same, but I got it another way. I took pictures of pictures, photographs of Jeremy's sketches and paintings of the pack. I'd started with the two portraits in his studio, the ones of my parents. In it, Dad wasn't much older than I am now. He'd been leaning against a wall, talking to Jeremy, with his mouth full of... I looked down at the apples under my hand. Dad talking, with his mouth full of an apple, his head bursting with some idea that couldn't wait until he chewed and swallowed, like Kate. But now in that painting, I see something uncomfortably close to a mirror. The portrait of Mom is very different. In it, she looks dangerous, almost feral. That was Jeremy capturing sides of my parents seen only by those who knew them best. I have other paintings on my phone, too, of Pack Brothers, some gone before I was born. Like, I mentally zoom in on one portrait. It's Mom in her 20s, sitting on the sofa. Her legs are drawn up, and she's leaning sideways in deep, almost conspiratorial conversation with a packmate, her best friend. He's laughing at some inside joke, the kind that best friends have, the kind I used to have with Kate. His head is thrown back, and I see him and... Elijah. That's who I see in his profile. I don't just see Elijah in that painting either. I see Kate, as she'd been last night with Elijah, the two of them laughing at some joke the rest of us didn't get. I remember the first time I saw that picture, and I hear Mom's voice. That's your namesake, Logan. I met him just after I met your dad. He died a few years before you were born, and your dad knew it would mean a lot to me if we named you after him. You were friends, I say, and it's not a question. Even as a kid, I could see the answer in the painting. She smiles. We were very good friends. Logan Johnson. When I focus on that mental image of the portrait, I see the differences between Logan and Elijah. Logan was lighter-skinned. His mother was Caucasian. Their features aren't an exact match either. In the first portrait, Logan also has locks, longer than Elijah's. And that could mislead me, make me jump to a conclusion. But I've seen photos of Logan Johnson taken long after he'd shorn off the college-era locks and become a lawyer. Yet another reason I've leaned toward that occupation. I can pull up those later pictures and still see the overwhelming resemblance to Elijah in his profile, in his eyes, and mostly in his smile. Elijah is Logan Johnson's half-brother. And Elijah knows it. He knows who his brother was. Knows Logan was Pack. Knows he was murdered in a war between Mutts and Pack. Yet, that's not how Elijah sees things, is it? It actually kinda was a gang. Elijah knows who we are. He also knows who we are in relation to his brother. And it is very clear how he feels about that. Elijah blames the pack for his brother's death. He tried to hide from Kate, tried to hide the fact he's a werewolf, and now that we know, he's hiding the connection to his brother. I had good reason to be suspicious. Elijah is up to something. I take two steps in the direction Elijah disappeared. Then I stop short. I will confront him. I will get to the bottom of this. But first, I need to tell Kate. Otherwise, if I go after him, she'll think the worst of me. And we don't need that. We really don't. Chapter 25. Logan. I'm heading outside to talk to Kate about Elijah when one of the counselors stops me. It's a guy I haven't met before, He's wearing a team necromancer shirt that looks slept in. Judging by his face, though, he hasn't slept at all. That could mean he was up all night partying, but his face sags, making him look 10 years older. His eyes dark with deep exhaustion. I remember what Kate and Elijah said about whispers in the woods. Werewolves don't usually hear ghosts, but it's possible that a whisper or two could break through if the ghosts are strong enough, or if there are enough of them. That might explain this necromancer's exhaustion. Ghosts often pester them to deliver messages, as if a necromancer's sole purpose is to play Spirit World FedEx. "Is everything all right?" I ask him.
"Hell if I know," he mutters, low enough that he probably doesn't mean for me to hear it. Then he says louder, "Trisha needs to speak to you. I'm supposed to escort you to her office to wait." In other words, she's heard about the trouble last night. Well, I knew I'd need to deal with this. Best to get it over with. And I won't mind having access to her office while I wait. Maybe I can find my cell phone. The necromancer takes me upstairs and down a hall to an unmarked door. He opens it and waves me inside. The door shuts, and I look around. This isn't the office. Not the main one, at least. It's walk-in closet-sized with a desk and a few chairs. The empty coffee mug on the desk proclaims, "Life is short. Do stuff that matters." And there's a laptop cord hanging from the sole outlet. The laptop, however, is nowhere in sight. I cock an ear to the door. I can hear the voices of what might be counselors. Before I can make out words, footsteps stream into another hall. Their meeting seems to have broken. I wait for Trisha, but all the footsteps move on toward the dining hall. When this end of the building goes silent, I ease open one desk drawer. Empty. Another reveals a notebook with a watercolor mermaid and an Anais Nin quote on the front. I must be a mermaid. I have no fear of depths and great fear of shallow living. I crack it open to find what seems to be Trisha's notes on the camp. A quick leaf through fails to divulge any dastardly experimental plan, nor does it hint at the disorganized chaos I'm seeing today. It's the polar opposite, in fact. Within these covers, Trisha has the conference organized in a way that would make Paige proud. It is meticulously detailed with the kind of schedule I'd hoped for, discussion and debate and education, mixed with outdoor excursions and activities. She even made changes yesterday morning to accommodate Kate and me. For example, orienteering had been changed to us leading a lesson in wilderness tracking, showcasing our skills in a way that suggests she actually knows something about werewolves. Yet, if that was her plan, why did she tell us to keep our supernatural race a secret? Something changed after she wrote this. It must have. I look at yesterday's schedule. When we arrived, the group was supposed to be listening to a panel discussion on half-demon subtypes. Instead, they'd been doing a team-building exercise. When I skimmed the schedule, though, I don't see any team-building exercises. After dinner yesterday, small group sessions were indeed on the schedule. I look at the list of groups. Something about it niggles the back of my mind. When I can't make the connection, I file it and move on. Following the group sessions came a bonfire and marshmallow roast. That didn't happen. Everyone had been in bed by 10, yet, according to this schedule, the bonfire went from 9 to 11, and Trisha had added a note that if the counselors weren't too tired and discussion was going well, the fire could extend to midnight for those who wanted to stay. I'm so engrossed in the notebook that I don't hear footsteps until the last second. I shove the notebook into the drawer
and I'm still sliding into my chair when the door opens. It's not Trisha, though. It's the exhausted necromancer. I get to my feet. If Trisha's delayed, I'd like to speak to my sister. I'll come right back. The necromancer shakes his head.
If I see Kate, I'll send her up. But I have my orders, and right now, I think we'd better just do what Trisha wants.
What's up? I say. This isn't the conference I expected. I pause and then meet his eyes. I don't think it's the one you expected either, nor the one Trisha planned. He hesitates, and he seems on the verge of admitting it, but then suspicion sparks behind his eyes. Whatever's going on here, I'm still a werewolf, possibly the cause of the trouble. I open my mouth to speak, but he turns and says, "Come on," to someone I can't see. Mason appears, his jaw set. When the necromancer reaches out, as if to prod him in, Mason only has to look at the guy's hand, and the necromancer pulls back. Mason walks in. The door shuts behind him. That's when Mason sees me.
Fuck.
Yes, I'm here. If this is about last night, though, those guys tattled, not me. Mason grunts and slumps into the chair beside mine. When our arms brush, he shoots me a look, as if that's my fault. I rise and walk to the desk, slide open the drawer, and remove the notebook again. Then I lean against the edge of the desk. This conference isn't going according to plan, I say.
You just figured that out? I thought you were some kind of genius.
I mean, it's literally not going according to plan. I have the schedule here. It was off course before Kate and I even arrived. If I ask what activities took place yesterday morning, is there any hope you actually participated and would know if they're different than what's here?
No, a beat. And yes?
No or yes.
The conjunction was and, not or. You asked two questions, I gave two answers.
I think that one through. No, you didn't participate. Yes, you'd know if they were different. He only grunts, which I suppose is as close to agreement as I'll get. I rhyme off yesterday morning's five activities.
Yes, 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 no, no.
Did you participate in any of them? I ask.
No.
Remind me why you're here.
Never told you why.
When I wait, expectantly, he groans, as if I'm a five-year-old pestering him incessantly.
Bribed, he says.
Bribed?
Yeah, that thing where someone has something you want, and to do that, you gotta do something you don't want to.
You agreed to attend the conference as a vampire representative, but whoever bribed you didn't specify that you needed to actually attend any sessions. The hint of a smile plays on his lips, one of self-satisfaction.
Yep.
So you're in self-imposed solitary confinement, I say. That must be a fun way to spend a week.
It's not solitary anymore, he shoots back, unfortunately.
Then go back into the forest. I fixed the tent for you. Well, mostly. And no, I'm not giving you our room no matter how much you grumble and glower. Feel free to try throwing me out again. I could use the exercise. I don't look up from the book as I talk. I'm thumbing through it. Sure, there's a clue here. It isn't anything obvious. It's just a random note that my mind made, analyzing the data and extracting a nugget of information that surfed past on a brainwave before I could snatch it. I keep skimming, hoping to see that wave rise again. Then it does. Half demons, I murmur as I skim the list of small group sessions. There are a lot of half demons here.
Because there are a lot of fucking half demons. Randy bastards breed like rabbits. And how come no one's concerned about them? Their daddies are demons. Demons! But no, the ones you need to watch out for are the overgrown puppies and the overgrown mosquitoes.
It's a matter of population infiltration and familiarity. As you said, there are a lot of half-demons. They take up an inordinate slice of the supernatural population pie, and therefore other supernaturals are familiar with them in ways they aren't with the much rarer werewolves and vampires. Familiarity may breed contempt, but the lack of it breeds fear.
Thank you, Professor Danvers.
I continue as if he hadn't spoken, still flipping pages, my words more musing aloud. Given their overall population density, it isn't surprising there are so many half-demons at this conference. All the subsets must be represented. Of the small group sessions, there's one for witches, one for sorcerers, one for necromancers, and four for half-demons. That suggests 50% of the campers are half-demon.
More like 65.
He's not being sarcastic. I don't comment on the fact he obviously paid more attention to his fellow campers than he let on. I'm curious about the staff, I say. Trisha is half-demon, and I saw a couple others.
One witch, one necro, four half-demons. There was supposed to be a sorcerer, but he started a new job or something. And no, I wasn't taking notes. I have a photographic memory.
A pause. Then he glances over.
Not going to correct me and say photographic memory is a myth.
That would be rude. He snorts a laugh and shakes his head.
You were thinking it, though.
I presumed you meant eidetic memory, and I would never correct you. You know what you have. I don't.
It's not eidetic memory, and yeah, I know what that is. When the brain takes a snapshot of an image and stores it in memory. It appears sometimes in children and disappears as they grow up. True photographic memory, the ability to recall text and images, has never been proven. It's a myth.
Another snort, disgusted now.
I wish.
I say nothing. I just wait. After a moment, he continues.
They were supposed to remove side effects. That's what the experiments were for. For the werewolves, that meant easier shifting and a lower predatory instinct.
While he may have heard this, I'm initially surprised he bothered to remember it. If he does have the fabled photographic memory, though, he'd remember whether he deemed it important or not.
That's where I got it from, he says. My memory. It came from the experiments. I bet they thought it was a feature. If you live for hundreds of years, what tweak might make life easier? An improved memory. So you don't forget things. So you don't forget a goddamn thing. Fucking amazing, right? All the mistakes you make? All the things you wish you could forget? You won't. All those people who come and go in your life? All the people you care about who die? Hell yeah, you don't want them to fade into pleasant dreams. Let's keep everything right there. Front and center.
I open my mouth and then realize he won't want sympathy or even understanding. The bitterness in his voice tells me that nothing I can say will help. The hell of a vampire's life is outliving everyone they know, everyone they care for, everyone they love. Eventually, those memories do fade, and there's mercy in that. There is no mercy in this. Giving Mason a photographic memory is the cold practicality of science, devoid of any consideration or empathy. Everyone wishes they had a better memory, so wouldn't that help vampires in their long lives? No. No, it would not.
What's this half-demon nonsense you're babbling about?
Mason says into the awkward silence. It takes me a moment to reroute my mental train. Then I nod and say, whatever's going on here, you and I aren't affected. Neither is Kate or Elijah, who are both werewolves. Holly is a witch, not affected. Alan, a guy we knew from years back, isn't affected either, and he's a sorcerer. Last night, the one guy who attacked us was also a sorcerer, but the other two were half... Footsteps tap along the hall. I shove the book back into the desk, but the footsteps head down the other hall instead. They're soft, barely audible. The steps stop. A moment later, someone taps on a door, and it's definitely in the other hall. Probably a camper hoping to speak to the counselors, knocking tentatively, knowing they're in no mood to hear complaints. I check my watch. It's been nearly an hour since they brought me in. I'm going to speak to Kate. If they find I'm gone, would you say I ran to the bathroom, please? He shrugs, which I take for agreement. I listen at the door. When I'm sure the hall is empty, I turn the knob. It doesn't budge. I jangle it, in case it's sticking. It isn't. We're locked in.
Chapter 26. Kate. After Elijah dumps me, I go to find my brother and let him know Paige isn't coming today. Logan isn't in his room. I knock and no one answers, so I say, "Yo, Mason, is my brother in there?" I don't get an answer. I knock again, and I know that if Mason was there, he'd tell me to fuck off and stop knocking. He doesn't. I head outside next. Holly's still there, Alan having wandered off. "Snacks," Holly says and puts out her hand. Then she catches my expression. "What's wrong?" I open my mouth to say that Paige isn't coming, and instead hear myself say, "I just got dumped by my fake boyfriend." She scrambles to her feet. "What?" I force a laugh. "No big deal. It was a joke, anyway." That's where I want to leave it. Instead, I hear, "I'm doing something wrong, aren't I? Giving off a..." I wave my arms. "Anti-boy vibe or something. Scaring them away, and I have no idea how or why." I rub my face. "Sorry, I don't mean to get angsty. Not over a fake boyfriend, it's just the way he did it. I still feel dumped." I suck in a breath. "Shit, stop that. Sorry." "Don't apologize. He obviously hurt you. What did he say?" "That it's over? Then he practically ran from me, when all I was trying to do was warn him about what happened to Logan last night." "The situation is getting worse, too, and now Paige isn't coming until tomorrow," I explain. Then we split up to hunt for Logan and Alan. I go back inside while Holly circles the building to check all the various groups out here. Inside, it's practically empty, and I wonder whether we've missed the call for a group meeting. The distant murmur of voices suggests we have. I'm standing at the top of the steps, ready to start tracking my brother's scent, when I realize that everyone who isn't outside seems to be in that meeting, which means the other end of the hall is silent, the end of the hall where our cell phones are kept. I creep in that direction. If I hear so much as a cough, I'll retreat. I continue to the office and put my ear to the door. Silence. I step back into the hall, close my eyes, and listen. Focus everything on that. Silence. Complete silence. I rap on the office door as softly as I can, but the sound still seems to echo in the silence. When no one answers, I turn the knob. It's locked, which surprises me because I thought Elijah broke it last night. I twist firmly, and it doesn't snap, it just disengages. Nice security. A credit card probably would have worked just as well. I slip into the room. It's brightly lit, the sun streaming through the skylight, which I'm sure is awesome for the electronics. With the door shut and the sun blazing down, it's got to be 90 degrees in here. Who the hell designed this place? I wipe away a bead of sweat and look around. There's a desktop computer,
the one Elijah tried breaking into. There's also a printer with paper in the output tray. I flip it over to see a stack of sheets for a workshop we were supposed to have this morning. The printer menu screen tells me they were printed late yesterday afternoon. No one even bothered collecting them. That's troubling, but it isn't why I'm here. Elijah said they keep the phones in a locker. I find three lockboxes.